Will it be enough to dissipate doubt over Ukraine's ability to hold out in a war of attrition with Russia? After months of delay, the U.S. House of Representatives finally approving a $60 billion military aid package for Kyiv, overruling the objections of Republican hardliners, Speaker Mike Johnson. In the end, praising lawmakers who came together, he says, quote, to answer history's call. That said, he'd also conferred first with Donald Trump. So, with U.S. elections ahead, did the momentum just swing against Russia? Or did we witness a one-off compromise that only pushes back the day when the Western-backed war effort runs out of steam? If U.S. support is so vital, it's because Europe's also been slow to boost promised deliveries of ammunition and air defense systems. Last year, Europe's share of NATO spending did rise to its highest level in a decade. What will 2024 have in store? Beyond just Ukraine, what will this arms race sparked by Vladimir Putin's bid for Kyiv have on the planet as a whole? Today in the France 24 debate, we're looking at that $61 billion lifeline for Ukraine. Joining us, political scientist Anastasia Shapochkina, president of the Eastern Circles think tank. Thanks for being with us.
Good evening.
Thanks as well to Samantha DeBenzard, associate fellow at the think tank at Chatham House. Good to see you.
Good evening.
He's our man in Kyiv, France 24 correspondent Gulliver Craig, gracing us with his presence in the studio.
Good evening. Nice to be here.
And Craig Capitis, contributing editor to the Daily Beast, author of Bear Hunting with the Politburo. How are you?
Good.
Your reactions on the hashtag F24Debate. So what did convince the Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives, the same Mike Johnson who 2 years ago voted with pro-Trump hardliners against Ukraine funding, last week took on his former fellow backbenchers, stating, quote, I could make a selfish decision and do something that's different, but I'm going to do here what I believe to be the right thing.
Three of our primary adversaries, Russia and Iran and China, are working together, and they're being aggressors around the globe. And they're a global threat to our prosperity and our security. Their advance threatens the free world, and it demands American leadership. If we turn our backs right now, the consequences could be devastating.
Anastasia Shapochkina, what convinced Mike Johnson?
I think it must be a number of factors, because the negotiations have been lasting for a very long time. And from what I understand, what convinced him is a compromises behind it, which allowed him at the same time to keep his job while allowing finally to put this bill for consideration on the floor.
Gulliver Craig?
Well, I'm not an expert on U.S. politics, and I probably don't know enough about Mike Johnson to offer an answer to that. But I think that he was convinced that if this didn't get voted, the consequences really would be bad, that Ukraine would lose the war perhaps soon, you know, that think there could be a real collapse. And I think perhaps they had thought, some of these Republicans before then, that they could carry on until the election without some major calamity occurring in Ukraine. And I think maybe they realized that it was actually more, you know, urgent than that.
So people want it to be in a holding pattern at least till the elections, Craig Capitis?
Well, I don't know about that, but it's hard to figure out what's going on in the American collective mind right now. But what Stosh said is absolutely true. There was this package that was put together to push. There were a lot of factors. And as the Daily Beast reported last November, based on interviews with U.S. Congressman Steve Cohen, who's from the Bible Belt, and two senators who wanted to speak with us off the record.
Because just to remind our viewers, Mike Johnson is from Louisiana.
He's from Louisiana, and he's also a Baptist, a Bible thumper. And few people knew, as Congressman Cohen told the Daily Beast, is they deployed representatives from Ukraine's 105,000-member Baptist community, which is the largest religious community, correct me if I'm wrong, Stosh, in Ukraine after Orthodox, Protestant sect. And at the time, what Congressman Cohn said, the world is a strange and crazy right now, and the Ukrainians certainly aren't going to get Republicans on board without help. Evangelicals are the only way left to educate more Americans, And that's precisely what they did. And that was a huge contributing factor because he's a born-again Christian, Mike Johnson. So don't discount that. We laughed at it in November. Guess what? It came true.
There have been calls in Ukraine to deploy these Baptists during the election campaign as well to swing states.
Yeah, even the Ukrainians are actually... think that the Baptist factor played a role. There was a young man from Odessa went to Washington about 10 days ago. His wife and child were killed in the strike and one of the strikes on Odessa in March. His wife was the daughter of a pastor. He went, he met Mike Johnson in Washington. And a number of people are attributing this as one of the factors that changed his mind, but not the only one. He's also been going to more and more intelligence briefings. He's had intelligence briefings with William Burns, the head of the CIA. He's had he had a lot of people with in-depth knowledge of Ukraine really telling him what the situation is like. Chuck Schumer, the head of the Democratic majority in the Senate, was in Ukraine recently. He's also been speaking to Mike Johnson. So I think it really was a combination of factors. But a lot of analysts are actually saying that the emotional issue, the emotional realization of what's been happening to ordinary people in Ukraine, that the war being brought home to him actually was a big contributing factor. That is what people in Ukraine believe, and that is what people in the US who were well-informed and more well-informed than I am seem to think as well.
I mean, we saw afterwards the scenes of a hardline Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene, a congresswoman, saying we're going to depose Mike Johnson as Speaker, as his predecessors have been. You're a former political officer at NATO, NATO which relies squarely on the United States, and we've been talking for months about how there's this isolationist swing in the United States. Is the events of the last 48 hours prove that wrong to a degree?
I think it's far too early to sell, but you know what Churchill said? She said, Churchill said, you can always count on the Americans to do the right thing once they've exhausted every other option. So maybe we're beginning to see them do a bit of the right thing. You know, they've always, whenever Europe has been in conflict, World War One, World War II, the Americans tried to stay out until they realized that they couldn't stay out anymore.
Anastasia Chapochkina.
I would like to add to that fine analysis also the fact that this last week there were six congressmen who visited Kyiv as well. Maybe that also helped. Maybe they have also interacted, because there is nothing like actually going there and experiencing what the people in Ukraine experience than your whole understanding of what the point of the anti-missile defense systems changes, the whole understanding of how many, what it means not to have enough.
Forgive me for being cynical, Anastasia, but you can see all the horror in the world. If you come back and you feel as though the people who vote for you aren't going to back you, you're going to vote against.
People who vote for you are going to back you or not based on what they are fed via the information channels. And you can cast your choice, your political choice, as a demonstration of strength. And that's something that the Republicans have continuously pursued. So far, they've pursued it in their chasing of the Mexicans off the American border, or their efforts to do that unsuccessfully. And they can as well pursue that in chasing the Russians from Ukrainian border, like before they have pursued it in chasing whatever terrorists from Iraq and Afghanistan. And this is just another normal, expected manifestation of the strengths by the Republicans. It's just now it would be in another place if we're really talking about that particular political set.
There is another issue as well, which is financial, which is part of this aid package is going to be used to help the U.S. government buy weapons directly from U.S. producers. So it's going to boost the U.S. economy. It's going to boost the production of weapons in certain states where there is, that are actually represented by hardline anti-Ukraine Republicans, if that notion, if we can invent that notion,
exactly.
Maybe. So there is also...
Well, Mike Johnson sold that as new, but that's something that's been on the table
for a long time. But I think the reluctance to help Ukraine was also political. And again, I don't want to sink into conspiracy theories here, but we know how powerful the Russians are. What the presence of the Russians are and their penetration in the U.S. Republican Party. You speak to people in Europe, you speak to people in the US, there's this joke about, oh, how much has Putin spent to buy up the Republicans? There have been rumors about Mike Johnson as well, whose election campaign in 2019 was financed by Russian businessmen. He then gave the money back. But there are a lot of, I think there's a multiplicity of factors, many of which that we are not aware of. They're not in the public domain.
Final question on this. Craig Capitis, Mike Johnson making this stance for history, but not before first consulting with Donald Trump, who backed off telling him not to approve the Ukraine aid. So at the end of the day, was it Trump's call and why?
I don't have a clue. All I know is what you're watching is political theater, and that we're going to come back to this point in 6 or 7 months when they run out of money. And let's cut right to the chase here. You know, everyone is being very opportunistic to take advantage of giving this money to the heroes of Ukraine. But by any estimation, and I could go down the list, there's going to be a hell of a lot more dead Ukrainian heroes if they don't get air cover against Russia.
Let's talk about that now.
Yeah, well, that's the story, because they're not getting it.
Let's talk about it. After the breakthrough in Congress, the Russians making their guns do the talking, the Kremlin claiming the capture of the village of Novomykolaivka, that's southwest of Donetsk, this one day after affirming it had taken control of the settlement of Bodanivka. Both those claims unconfirmed. What is confirmed is that the fighting continues. Nicholas Rushworth has more.
Nice.
Ukrainian forces are facing a critical shortage of munitions on the ground, as well as a lack of air defenses. Soldiers in the Kharkiv region expressed relief at Saturday's vote in the U.S. House of Representatives that clears the way for deliveries of U.S. military aid.
This is good news. There'll be weapons, there'll be ammunition, there'll be shells. We have a catastrophic shortage of shells right now. If we get help, everything will be fine.
It's not only artillery that needs ammunition. We all need ammunition to use against the enemy. So in my opinion, we 100% need the help. It's hard, but we're holding on.
The U.S. aid package would provide Ukraine with nearly $14 billion to train, equip and finance the needs of the Ukrainian army, which has been suffering a string of defeats. Russian forces have been exploiting shortages in Ukrainian defenses with a targeted offensive on the Kharkiv region. That has led to severe damage to energy infrastructure, including to the city of Kharkiv itself, the country's second largest, where nearly 200,000 people are without power. 50% of the region's population have power outages. Analysts argue a larger offensive cannot be ruled out given the intensity of recent assaults.
And there's talk, Gulliver Craig, that there is going to be in the month of May, perhaps, a big Russian offensive. Certainly that's what's being talked up.
Yeah, that's what Kirilo Budanov, the head of Ukrainian military intelligence, said in an interview yesterday. And he is always trying to put a positive spin on everything. He was last year really saying that they would definitely take back Crimea before the end of the year and all kinds of claims like that. And yesterday in his interview, the most positive thing he could find to say was it's not going to be Armageddon. So they're expecting it to be pretty tough in late May.
You heard in that report that soldiers saying it's tough, but we're hanging on. Is that your sense?
Well, look how fast the Russians are advancing. It's not spectacular, is it? They're taking villages here and there, despite the fact that the Ukrainians at the moment have got this terrible manpower and ammunition disadvantage. I think there's cause for hoping that even immediately they can start using more of what ammunition they do have because they know that more is coming. So I'm optimistic that they've been able to hold the line so far and that they probably will be able to continue to hold the line. But the big question is, will the Russians take Chasiv Yar, this town to the west of Bakhmut, which is highly strategically important? It's on the hill and they're really, really close to it. And if that's
The great irony in this has always been, and I think it's an irony forgotten, is the West is paying for the Russian war machine. You know, Putin for 24 years has taken advantage of Western largesse, Western financial capital institutions. And we're still giving him money for oil. And what has the guy got? You know, all he's got is it's a gangster economy. They got a seat on the UN Security Council, and they got nuclear weapons. You know, so this is going to continue until this guy's head is cut off. And I don't see that happening because he takes advantage of the West, and we are unable or afraid to do anything to take advantage of him to take him out. Now, you're the policy expert. How come we don't go in there and just smack him around a bit?
Well, I think we'd do more than just smack him around if we could go in there. But nukes, he's got nukes. Right. He's the best advertisement for nuclear weapons. If you've got nuclear weapons, you can do what you want to your neighbor and you'll get away with it. And the Ukrainians are saying to this all the time, listen, we're fighting. We're not afraid of his nukes, and we're the ones he's going to be targeting. We're not afraid. What are you guys so afraid of? We have crossed every single one of Putin's red lines. The beginning of the war, it was, oh, we're not going to give any tanks. The tanks arrived. Oh, no long-range missiles. The long-range missiles arrived. Oh, no F-16s. Now the F-16s are more or less a fait accompli. So,
In a very small quantity.
In a very small quantity, yes. But it's symbolic. So the West is afraid of Putin's nukes, and he uses the nuclear threat. This war is already a nuclear war in the sense that it's carried out under a nuclear umbrella and under a nuclear threat.
Then riddle me this, Samantha. Why is it every time that Putin does something, the West says, we're going to trigger more sanctions, okay? It's like the weather, you know? It's going to rain. We're going to trigger more sanctions. Why didn't the poltroons in Brussels and D.C., why didn't they trigger all these sanctions within hours of Russia invading Ukraine?
Too many vested interests.
Ah, so now we're getting down to it. Okay, so how long are these vested interests going to last?
And how long is the argument that we mustn't provoke Russia going to last? Yeah. How long are Western leaders, there still, Olaf Scholz, I'm sure, and lots of people. In a way, it's a shame we don't have some of them on this debate to try to put the case that there's still a risk of provoking Russia into doing something more. I think the Russians are doing everything they can.
Are you talking specifically about the Taurus missiles?
The Germans don't want to send the Taurus because they're afraid of escalation.
Yeah, good point. Taurus,
I mean, the Ukrainian point of view is that the Russians have escalated as high as they can, apart from using nuclear weapons. And as every red line gets crossed and the Russians do not use the nuclear weapons, maybe it's because they're never going to, you know?
Exactly.
But and our viewers here in France, they are compelled by the nuclear argument.
By Vladimir
they are scared of a direct confrontation.
Of course, but because they don't know the history of India and China and Pakistan relationship. And that relationship has proven time and again that three nuclear powers put together aren't getting into a nuclear conflict, although they repeatedly have military confrontation. This is number one. And second, because they don't know the recent history of Turkey-Russia relations and of Belarus-Russia relations. And those are the two leaders, the Lukashenko, as ironic as it is, and Erdogan, who showed to the whole world the only way to work with Vladimir Putin. How long did it take to freeze Russia-Turkish relations after Turkey shot down a Russian military airplane in 2015? It took less than a year, and the relationship got right back to normal. And Turkey shot down Russian military airplane because the only language that Putin understands is the language of force.
And an assassination in Istanbul of a Russian diplomat.
Gulliver Craig, the Polish president, saying he's willing to harbor some of NATO's nukes. And that's been drawing attention this Monday.
I don't know. Are they going to deploy nukes in Poland?
That's what he's offered it.
They'd probably love that, right? Because it would just, you know, be a boost to his own popularity because the Poles are very keen on being better defended. And they're one of the only, apart with the Baltics, you know, they're one of the only European countries whose populations are really willing to vote for massively more defence spending and more defence, which is one of the big problems of the rest of Europe, is that leaders might realise it's important to spend more on defence. Are the populations willing to follow them and vote for the parties that will want to do that?
All right, let's move away from hypotheticals to something a little bit more concrete. The $61 billion dollar package, it means that once it's signed, it's expected to be signed on Tuesday, that within days, the Ukrainians will start to get shipments that are being stored right now the other side of the border. What more can we say about that, Anastasia Shapochkina?
Well, that, as Samantha has already pointed out, most of the money is going to stay in the US. That's the most important message, I think, to pass to the voters. No matter what budget is voted, no matter where, in which country, most of that money stays in that country. And that's going to be $50 billion out of 60, more or less, that are going to be actually going to that country. Then second, the for some of it is going to take days. I think for other is going to take longer time because the shipment of weapons, it takes time. Hopefully, some of it has been prepared, but then other maybe will have to be manufactured because we're looking also at a longer range timeline. And yes, for those weapons which are already at the border, let's say with Poland and Ukraine or sitting in Polish warehouses, they can be shipped maybe faster, but for others, it's going to take time. And then it depends also if the aviation is also going
to be. So will it have an immediate impact on the battlefield?
I think it will have immediate impact because of what Gulliver said, that actually gives them the freedom to use what they already have. Because the whole problem with holding back weapons, it just influences the strategic planning. You can only plan how intense you're going to respond to Russian bombing if you know how much you have in the store, how much weapons, how much ammunition. If you don't know, which is all of the discussion, what it brings into the reality is that it brings this uncertainty, then you start saving weapons and then you start responding less. And then you have either Chernihiv, which happened precisely because Ukrainians ran out of the...
Let's just remind our viewers, Chernihiv last week...
Last week on Wednesday morning, they shot down 4 rockets out of 7 and 3 fell. And because they ran out of ammunition for shooting those rockets. And Zelensky said it openly. And this is the problem. That's going to be an immediate impact. But then there is going to be... The expectation is also, of course, that this is not just going to cover what they've already had in mind, but eventually the discussion is going to continue to increase the amount of F-16s or other airplanes supplied, and also potentially, hopefully, to advance the discussion on attackums, which, from what I understand, are not going to be on the table yet. It's something that the Ukrainians have been asking from the very beginning of the war.
And you were in Chernihiv last week, yep. Samantha de Bendern. How much has Russia over this winter been able, because that was the big prediction going into winter, to degrade critical infrastructure like energy?
Well, that has been the target of recent strikes. But if you're talking about Chernihiv region, we actually met the governor of the Chernihiv region. He said the region is coming under shelling every single day. There have been over 1,000 cases of shelling since the beginning of this year in the Chernihiv region. So that they're not big impacts like the one we saw on Wednesday when there were 17 dead and a big hotel was destroyed in the city center. But yes, the critical infrastructure outside Kiev, a very big power storage station was hit 2 weeks ago. Kharkiv is in a very, very dire situation with very frequent power cuts. The railway structure in Dnipro was also impacted last week. But just to go into how quickly the American aid can get there, the Pentagon said that, for instance, in terms of the 155-millimeter artillery shells, which are what the Ukrainians desperately need on the front line, there are storage places in Europe where these shells are waiting, and they can be shipped to Ukraine within days. And regarding the Patriots, the Americans are looking to replace some of their systems with something a bit more modern. So they could actually get some missiles to the Patriots, because you have the Patriot system, but you also need the missiles to fire off, and they can be shipped relatively fast. The Pentagon was keen to emphasize the fact they have an excellent logistics chain. So we'll have to see. And President Biden said he will sign it as soon as it has gone through the Senate and the bill. So I would say that within a week, we might already see something on the battlefield, the beginning of a change on the battlefield. Plus, the Europeans have some Patriot battery systems. The Germans have said they will transfer their Patriot battery system. They're also going to be transferring an Iris-T system, which is another kind of anti-missile system.
Yeah, and the Germans who are leading this anti-missile coalition, a bit like the one that the Czechs are leading when it comes to getting more ammunition. News of the breakthrough in the U.S. Congress, music to the ears of EU foreign and defense ministers meeting this Monday in Luxembourg.
After the important vote in the U.S. Congress, we have finally reached a situation where the hearts of the two most important Ukraine supporters, the Europeans and the Americans, are beating in sync again.
beating in sync again with nuances after the German initiative to provide more air defense, with the French slowly but surely ramping up their own production, the gaze turns to Greece and Spain. Those two countries who are among those being asked to provide some of those anti-aircraft systems.
I think they've got 13 Patriot systems between them, Greece and Spain. Is that right? Seems a huge amount. Germany's only sending one. Surely they could spare. Ukraine's asking for seven.
The Greek government has said, for instance, no, it can't do it because it needs to ensure its own defense, i.e. keep an eye on Turkey. But
Zelensky said this in his press conference at the end of the year, really not that long ago. Zelensky was responding to questions from European journalists, saying that he understands that the European countries aren't going to give up their air defense systems because they need them, and that's why they really need the Americans to send theirs. He's changed his tune since then. He's now saying no. What was it he said most recently? That it's not an air defense system if it's just sitting there doing nothing. It's only an air defense system if it's defending people.
You know, we have this knack to focus on, you know, guns and ammo, which makes sense, right? Makes a lot of sense. But there's a lot more going down there that they don't have. You know, the U.S. Center for Disease Control says there's an alarming increase in disease there and not enough drugs. The U.N. World Food Program says there's going to be 11 million Ukrainians who are food insecure.
I don't understand. Why is that, though?
Because there's not enough arable land left to grow enough stuff.
But Ukraine is exporting huge amounts of agricultural produce.
This is their two-year look ahead in reporting that we did last December, and that there's a real problem. The UN World Food Program, on the record, 11 million Ukrainians is food insecure, facing another two bitterly cold winters without power, and they say that this coming winter, one step closer to a hunger catastrophe. I mean, that's the UN. It's not me.
I think they're food insecure because they're dependent on humanitarian aid, but the humanitarian aid is coming.
Well, that's it. They're dependent on humanitarian aid. They're dependent on increased deliveries of drugs, pharmaceuticals. And the question is, who's paying for that and how much longer can that be sustained by the West, you know, as...
So let me ask you, Gulliver, because you're the local from Kyiv, right? When you think back to February of 2022, right now, what's ordinary life like in the Ukrainian capital as far as this goes? And the trajectory that...
There's no food insecurity in the Ukrainian capital. Life is very, ordinary, and restaurants are opening, actually, and there's a lot of economic life going on in Kyiv, but everybody is anxious. Everybody knows somebody who's on the front line. Most people know somebody who's died. And I mean, I really think I'm looking forward to going back there in a way. I've been off for a couple of weeks. That since this US aid package was passed, that will have given people a sigh of relief because people were really beginning to think that Kyiv could again come under threat. There was a risk that the front line could really collapse. Now people will be a bit more relaxed, but it's more like what's happened with this aid package is, it seems like the worst can probably be avoided for now, but for how long?
Here's the thing. It buys a few months.
Yeah.
What Craig is talking about is predictions looking 2 years ahead. And it's a war of attrition. And in a war of attrition, with a front line, as you said at the outset, that doesn't move much, at one point or another, one of the two sides just can't take it anymore.
We can just only hope, and maybe this is the tendency we're observing, that the Western leaders are moving closer towards believing what a lot of them say. Mm. As Macron actually said in his recent interview, the French president, we can't be continually saying that Russia will attack other countries in Europe if we don't defeat Russia in Ukraine, and also not giving Ukraine the wherewithal and being ready to make a major commitment to defend Ukraine. And so, you know, the change in rhetoric from Macron, I think, is quite encouraging, but they're still a long way off really giving Ukraine what Ukraine really needs.
The change of rhetoric from Macron was certainly felt in Kyiv. I mean, we had some meetings at very high level in the presidential administration, in the parliament, in various ministries, and they all said, just say thank you to your president for us, for what he is saying, for not allowing Russia to set the tone of the discourse, but for actually being the one who sets the discourse. And there's an old concept which comes all the way from Soviet diplomacy, which is called reflexive discourse. It's basically creating the narrative that everyone else will follow. So Putin has created the narrative that I have nuclear weapons and you really just cannot do anything to contradict me. And now President Macron has said, we don't care what you have. If we decide that something is necessary, we're not going to exclude anything, and nothing that you say will dictate to us how we behave.
So what does... again, if this war of attrition... I saw you shaking your head when I said that a war of attrition ends badly for one side.
Yeah, this is exactly... That's another Russian discourse. They say, not only we have nuclear weapons, we have more people, more weapons. We have more disregard for human life. We can just do this meat grinder until we go entirely population-less. And Ukrainians have 3 times fewer people, and that's actually the problem, demography and the energy sector right now. But just to say, look... The big difference between Ukraine and, let's say, Syria, I don't know, Libya, Afghanistan, is that they have a functioning government, which is there today, ensuring the functioning of that country, and so that hunger prospect remains something as an economic prediction between now and 2 years from now, which is something that, in the long run, we're in the long term.
But Vladimir
we're all
Putin
dead.
Can send more cannon fodder to the front, whereas in Ukraine, changing the rules of conscription is proving politically difficult.
Well, anywhere changing the rules of conscription is proving politically difficult. But the war of attrition doesn't have to necessarily exhaust the other side into submission, as the example of Israel today, not popular, but historically has shown. But historically, that is the country which is overwhelmingly surrounded by a much massively bigger neighbors who can also make that argument. And yet they've sticked around. I'm not saying about today's events. I'm saying historically, right now, this has been a country because they've had that government which has managed somehow to but they haven't. They wouldn't have ever sticked around without the U.S. support, continuous U.S. support, Craig, which has cost much more
Absolutely.
Than anything that the U.S. has given to Ukraine so far and will give in the future.
And then
the
we US should
has
give
given
them. We should.
Hundreds times more to Afghanistan, which has never had a functioning government. The U.S. has given hundreds times more to Vietnam, which has never had at that time a functioning government while it was receiving the giveaway.
They didn't have nukes.
And has never had and has given hundreds times more to Israel, which has been sustainingly there and remains there in despite of his behavior, thanks to the U.S. giveaways. And yes, it is very expensive, including the U.S. has given Israel nukes. Israel didn't invent nukes, okay? So yes, thanks to the U.S., they can have food, Israel. They can have, and Israel is not the only country. Jordan is absolutely dependent on the U.S. Egypt is a lot dependent on
America's
the U.S.
America's a great country, isn't
and
it?
Just to say that, you know, yes, of course, it's possible to sustain
the
for
deal,
70
the deal,
years
the deal,
yourself.
The deal is... You're fighting on the wrong front. What you said about Macron, I think, is the most important thing that's been said tonight, because Macron is the new Navalny. Macron...
Didn't end well for Navalny.
Yeah, right. Well, it might not.
Maybe that's why
Johnson is afraid he's going to
come
back. The Russian, he keeps putting off his visit, right?
The Russian people neither have the means nor the incentive to overthrow Putin. Okay. So this is where the
You're saying that the Russian president can keep sending
cannon fodder to the front. Yes, and this is why what Macron said, you know, what are the Russians doing to try and get, they can't do anything, they'll be jailed. Putin let the flower shops stay open because to pile the flowers on Navalny's grave because flowers, you know, don't kill people. Otherwise, he would have shut the flower shops down. I was there for 10 years. I know how these people think. They're gangsters. They're thugs. And the point of it is you're going after Putin here. And everything that you just said about America, and we are a great country, and you know what? We screw the pooch a lot, and we've screwed the pooch here. But don't take your eye off who the enemy is here. It's Vladimir Putin and his gangster collective. And until you shut them down, everything else we're talking about is rhetoric.
So
I'm stiff, solid of fear. I'm shattering, and I'm absolutely white like a wall because of what you're saying. Look, Ukrainians are not afraid of Putin. Don't get it. It's great. Get it. Ukrainians are
not
afraid
of
Putin.
That's evident. Right. That's evident. But you're running out of bodies to put into the trenches.
So that's why Macron said he's going to send more bodies.
Well, he said he won't rule it out.
He said he wouldn't
rule
it out.
Actually, sending them—it's definitely a big problem for Ukraine recruiting
So we began
people.
This conversation.
But I wanted to say there's something I think quite important that, you know, this issue of mobilization in Ukraine and how politically difficult it has been is because Ukraine is a democracy and there is political opposition and there is political debate and there are people, I think, cynically willing to take advantage of situations. And there's a risk in Ukraine, and I'm sure the Russians will be trying to encourage and push these people as much as they can, that a party of peace will emerge. As things go bad, if they continue to go not very well on the front lines, there are Ukrainian politicians who will start selling the idea that we could negotiate, we could freeze the conflict, we could stop the fighting.
And that's the real danger.
And yes. There's certainly, and the I mean, danger. I think a danger of that.
Yeah. You're right. Yeah. Agreed.
Unless you think that Ukraine can never win, in which case it would be better to freeze the conflict, right? But if you think that Ukraine can win, all those who are advocating
that argument,
opinion polls in Ukraine show that the amount of the percentage of Ukrainians in favor of negotiations, even though the Russians aren't proposing any kind of meaningful negotiations, nevertheless, you've got more than a third of Ukrainians, according to recent polls, in favor of negotiations, and close to the front line, surprise, surprise, nearly half, because they're the ones really, you know, suffering.
There is this question, and it's been put forward by some who watch this who say, because what? First of all, you need to define what does a military victory look like, and if it's unattainable by Ukraine, maybe there should be a negotiation sooner than later.
Well, first of all, I think in the West, there is no consensus on what a military victory would look like. We're kind of fumbling around here saying, oh, we have to support Ukraine for as long as it takes, or then we have to support Ukraine so that Russia doesn't win. There's all this sort of fluffing language. Nobody in the West, no leaders in the West have articulated what the West's goal is in helping Ukraine. And that has been a problem in the West's attitude towards Ukraine for the last 25 years. Russia knows what it wants. Russia wants to at least have complete control of the four regions it has annexed and potentially go further. I mean, not long ago, Medvedev and Putin were sort of talking about Kiev. And, of course, keep Crimea. I think that there is an emerging realization in Ukraine that, even though they will never say this, but that reconquering everything to the borders of 1991 will take a very long time. And that is why they had this peace conference that's going to happen in June in Switzerland. And what they want to do there, they want to get their partners on board to agree to, okay, what are our goals together? What are we really aiming for? Because no one has actually formulated this. It will probably be formulated behind closed doors.
But that would force Ukraine to state goals that are shy of the 1991
They don't have to state them in the open. You don't go into negotiation telling your partner, this is what I'm prepared to do. But at least to have... another rule of negotiation is you know what your bottom line is. And I think that what Ukraine and the partners are aiming for, and this is a hunch, this is kind of feeling things on the ground, is what would be actually settled for in a first phase on the understanding that any peace has to be lasting. It's not about freezing a conflict. It's about getting something that will last, that will bring peace to Ukraine for the long haul.
So you have that one third that Gulliver was talking about of opinion in Ukraine that is in favor of the negotiation. Mm-hmm. What does the other two thirds want?
The president has stated of Ukraine as the kind of optimistic or the top ask. And that has been very stable throughout this time. And that's Ukraine within the borders of 1991. Now, the former commander of the former commander of military forces who's been fired after that, basically who left his position, Zaluzhny wrote that it would be very difficult to reconquer the territories lost now because of the fortifications that Russians have built, and overcoming these fortifications is just... So there would be probably a necessity to settle at some point. However, the line that a lot of people are repeating, and this is not just on top in the government that, you know, people we met, as Samantha noted last week, but also the people who have, you know, families held hostage by the Russians. A lot of those families and a lot of those people, they come from the east of Ukraine or they come from the Crimea and from the south. And they understand that there are many more people left there who are actually in the conditions which are described by Craig and by the UN, but the UN doesn't dare to put the finger on Russia and say that, yeah, In some of those places, there's no more male population, like Donetsk and Luhansk regions, right? Because all of them have been expended by Russia by being thrown into the trenches to fight their fellow countrymen. And so the stated position, therefore, yes, of course, may look ambitious. It absolutely is militarily very difficult to attain. I think that the goal of the peace summit, I agree with Samantha 100%, that is to see where the countries are, not just the Western allies, but also, more importantly, also the global south, yeah. Because that's the eventual target, getting to the UN and getting within the General Assembly the majority of the votes which support the position of the Ukraine, but which does not reflect, which is as far as possible, which reflects the position stated by Russia, supported by China, because when China states their own 10 points, it pretty much is a reflection of the Kremlin discourse, and which can result in securing as many Ukrainian lives, including on the occupied territories, as possible. And that's why, so far, in the official discourse, Ukraine absolutely is not ready to say, and in official discourse, but also when we talk to people who live there, to say that, yeah, we're ready to give up those territories. Because everybody understands it's not about the territories. It's about the people who live there. And everybody has relatives there. Some people have children there. Some people, and this is the problem. And that's why for Ukrainians it's so hard to go for the government to negotiate, because it's a real democracy. The government, when it negotiates something the population really doesn't support, it is going to be physically taken out of the seat and thrown onto the street.
Yeah, it's worth noting. I mentioned 30% are in favor of negotiations. I don't know the percentages, but you've got to remember that there is a significant number of Ukrainians who will not accept any kind of settlement, especially soldiers who are fighting in the Ukrainian armed forces who are from the occupied territories. Yeah. They're fighting to go home to get that.
Then what for?
They can't, you know. So it will be very, very difficult for Ukraine to go for any kind of settlement. And also, what I wanted to say before is the Russians want the territory that they currently control for the sake of holding that territory. They want it. In order to prevent Ukraine from developing as a prosperous Western integrated democracy. And so leaving the Russians with those territories will not really solve the problem.
And also to advance, because that's what every single Ukrainian government official keeps repeating, is that this is just going to give the Russians time, more time. Yeah. They've already gotten 2 years. They built up their military complex. They built up the system of alliances, which helps them and definitely supplies them with ammunition. And now more time, a settlement, is just going to make them prepare more, advance further, foster better.
The concurrent plot that's going on with the scenario that you guys just laid out is this war is going to drag on until Russia's quartermaster system in the West is completely defenestrated, totally, and all of the seized Russian assets are turned over to the Ukrainian government. And yeah, they're also going to need air cover, but none of us here, I think, see that coming. But this is shutting down Russia's quartermaster system and bankrupting Putin's criminal enterprises and ability to take advantage of Western largesse is the most critical aspect right now.
So later in the week, it was interesting because we heard that clip of Mike Johnson at the beginning of this conversation talking about the three adversaries, Russia, China, and Iran, U.S. Secretary of State, who's due to meet his Chinese counterpart later this week. This isn't just playing out between two nations. Obviously, we've talked about Europe and the West, but this is a global conflict. What will be the at this point, will the U.S. raise the stakes when it comes to China?
Well, the problem with China is that China is such an important trading partner for the U.S. Mm. So, you know, we talked about Russia, we talked about Iran. You know, they're not really trading partner. Well, Iran is not a trading partner at all. Russia is still, there is still trade happening with Russia in particular in terms of giving fuel to the US's nuclear energy industry. But China is still a very, very big, important trading partner of the United States. So that is a completely different relationship. But what we are seeing here, we are seeing the world settling into different blocks. And one of the Kremlin's big sort of think masters, Sergei Karaganov, came out with a very, very long piece recently in which he talks about the fact that Russia has to now dominate ideologically, economically, what he calls the global south, which is an imperfect term because these countries are so different, but that basically Russia has to bring into its fold, particularly ideologically, all the countries in Africa, all the countries in South America, and quite a part of Asia, and also have an alliance with China against the rest. You know, it's the West and the rest, which we are falling into here. So, and I think that China is slightly an outlier, that although it is definitely helping Russia, it is also very, very close to North Korea, China still has this very pragmatic reason to want to trade with the West. Its economy is not doing that well, and its economy is also dependent on its access to Western markets. And I think that is where the United States has definitely a lot of leverage there, a lot more than it has with Russia, and definitely a lot more than it has with Iran.
These blocks, you make it sound like a Cold War. Samantha de Benburn, I want to thank you so much for being with us. I want to thank Craig Capitis, Gulliver Craig, Anastasia Shapochkina. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.